Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the political crisis in Egypt with a political insider who knows many of the important players involved in what is widely described as a military coup. Dr. Mona Makram Abid, who recently resigned from the Shura Council in support of the Tamarod, that's rebellion, movement, joins us to discuss the opposition movement that galvanized around a rejection of the Morsi Muslim Brotherhood government and the extent to which Tamarod was used as a pretext by the military and old guard to seize power. Then we'll examine the role of Saudi Arabia in undermining the Morsi government through political and economic sabotage, while conversely rewarding the new government with $8 billion in aid as gasoline suddenly becomes available and the Mubarak-era police reappear to police the streets. Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss the ruling Saudi monarch's motives in undermining Egypt's progress towards democracy. Then finally, we'll address the legal questions surrounding the failure of the prosecution in the Trayvon Martin case with Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center for Children and Families in Gainesville, Florida. We will discuss the failure of not having an African-American on the jury, not allowing the issue of race to enter the trial, and inadequate jury instructions explaining all of the statutes in the Stand Your Ground law, particularly one that prohibits an armed citizen from being an aggressor. And joining us now is Dr. Mona Makram Abid, who recently resigned from Egypt's Shura Council in support of the Tamarod, that's rebellion movement. She is the head of the Committee on Social Rights at the National Council on Human Rights and is a distinguished lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the American University in Cairo, where she has been teaching for the past 17 years. Dr. Makram Abid was a member of the Parliament in Egypt from 1990 to 1995. Prior to that, she was appointed as an expert to the United Nations Committee for Policy Development and founded the Association of the Advancement of Education and is a founding member of the Arab Organization for Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mona Makram Abid.
Hello. Hello there, Ian.
So, Dr. Abid, is there any reason for one to suspect that the movement that you joined, Tamarod Rebellion, that galvanized the opposition? They got 22 million signatures on a petition and 17 million Egyptians took to the streets. But is it possible that, in a sense, the movement was used Tamarod was used as a pretext by the military and the old guard to seize power?
No, I don't think so. This was a genuine manifestation of people power. And it is a very creative and innovative movement by the youth today who have taken upon themselves, you know, to fight for their rights, to fight against tyranny, against despotism, and so on, and who are risking their lives. So I am in complete awe in front of their courage, and I was transfixed by everything they did, and I did sign the petition from the very beginning in support of them.
But who's in charge now? It looks like the military are in charge now, not the students, not the rebels, not the secular forces.
No, you can't have the students heading a country of 90 million. This is not the time now. But they will be in the picture, as you showed, as we saw when General Sisi ousted the former president. The former president, he brought in all these people.
So,
hello?
Yes, I can hear.
He brought in representatives from the Tamarod, representatives from the Azhar, which is the highest religious Islamic institution, the Pope, the highest institution of the Christian community. And some representatives. So this is what the former SCAF did not do after 2011. And I was an advisor to the SCAF for 1 year, between 2011 and 2012. So I don't think so. I think they are, for the moment, they are controlling everything, yes. But once the Constitution will be amended, they will be lurking in the background. And it's up to the political and the civic forces today to take up their responsibility, you know, and not the military. They are the ones who should take the responsibility today, first of all, to stop demonizing the Muslim Brothers, to strive instead for national reconciliation, to try to lure them back into the political process, because after all, they are part of the political landscape, and to try to establish together a new roadmap that will be conformed to the aspirations of the Egyptian people until we draft a constitution that is equitable, participatory, and inclusive.
And you mentioned, Dr. Mona Makram Abid, that you were advisor to the SCAF, that's the Supreme Council of the Military
Armed Forces.
And so what is your sense from having met with the generals, and particularly the new Defense Minister General Sisi, who was the spokesperson for this military takeover, which, of course, he was standing on stage with representatives of Al-Nur behind him and other Egyptians. So what's your reading on General Sisi?
My reading on General Sisi, he was one of the 19 generals with whom we used to meet. But he is younger, he is much more savvy, he is much more intelligent, and, you know, he's been trained in the United States, not in the Soviet Union. He will be much more open to understand the need for cooperation across the religious secular divide. And, you know, the future will depend on the statesmanship of the leaders and the effectiveness of the opposition and, of course, how they're going to design the new constitution. In my opinion, I think we should change the system into a parliamentary system, because this will provide for a more stable, inclusive future. And this is really what we want. We want to try to have cooperation, and the cooperation cannot be met by a presidential system where the presidency is a winner-take-all. So I think a well-designed parliamentary democracy will create a constitutional order that will encourage different parties to reach out to one another. And this is exactly what we want. We want also the emergence of a loyal opposition, because this is just as important to democratic consolidation as an effective democratic leader. So, as you see, we are faced with an intensely turbulent, polarized, and dysfunctional domestic political arena. We must all, you know, hold hands together to be able to navigate through the storm.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Mona Makram Abid, who recently resigned from Egypt's Shura Council in support of the Tamarod, that's rebellion movement. She is the head of the Committee on Social Rights at the National Council on Human Rights and is a distinguished lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the American University in Cairo, where she's been teaching for the past 17 years. Dr. Makram Abid is a member of the parliament in Egypt from 1990 to 1995, and prior to that, she was appointed as an expert to the UN Committee for Policy Development and founded the Association for the Advancement of Education and is a founding member of the Arab Organization for Human Rights. So what about the role of outside players in the extent to which it does appear that Saudi Arabia has played a role behind the scenes, as has Qatar, in supporting the Muslim Brotherhood government of Morsi? The feeling that a lot of analysts have is that the Saudi Arabians monarchy are very afraid that Egypt's democratic experiment will succeed, and that an alternative Islamic democratic system to their autocratic system in the kingdom is a threat to the kingdom's ruling family. So Are we reasonable in being skeptical about Saudi Arabia's role? Because suddenly they're throwing...
No, because everything changes every day. Today, Saudi Arabia is not the Saudi Arabia of 2 years ago when it was frightened from the uprising. Today, Saudi Arabia knows perfectly well that it must go through reform in their country. The world is evolving, and they have a new generation today that is much more demanding. As for Egypt, I believe that the new infusion of cash from the Gulf will stave off disaster for the time being and help figure out a way to phase out energy subsidies, because the main problem today is subsidies. I believe that this cash will try to restore some dynamism to the economy, to tourism, and secure the funding to cover Egypt's budget deficits. You know that subsidies make up 33% of Egypt's spending. And today the priority really is to restore order and security and to focus on bread and butter issues. These are the real issues. We also, on the other hand, so that the IMF, you know, in compliance with the IMF, we need transparent capitalism, not crony capitalism that has produced a greedy kleptocracy during the Mubarak regime. It was a corrupt coterie around the leadership, which only benefited them because they had a monopoly on political and economic power. What we want today is an economic and political competition based on fairness so that you can give everyone a chance. And, of course, if the Constitution is really based on the right and the respect of citizenship, then we can go forward. And I think that with this new government, one can be optimistic because all of them are very well-known personalities, very highly respected, whether it is in finance or other. All of them I know very well, and I think they should get all the support and the help from the international community.
Well, Dr. Muna Makhram Abid, of course, the Saudis did fund the Salafist Al-Nur party that came out of nowhere in the last parliamentary elections and came in second. And there have been reports during the Morsi period of gasoline shortages and various shortages. And, of course, the police weren't on the street at all. They were kind of in silent rebellion since for the last 2 years, and now suddenly they're back on the streets, and suddenly there's plenty of gasoline at the service station. So one can be skeptical about whether or not there was an element of economic sabotage going on.
Look, all these are very contradictory statements. Whatever it is, there is no there's no time now to delve into these past events. And let's look at what is happening today. Let's look at the future. Let's look at how we can all help Egypt to restore order, first of all, and to become, you know, the civil, democratic, egalitarian country that we are looking for. And I think that we've proved it in 2011 with a very peaceful and democratic uprising against a dictatorship. And once again, the Tamarut people, for whom I'm in awe and I have great respect for, have also ousted the president who was verging on tyranny and autocracy.
So in terms of the broader issues, though, with you mentioned state subsidies and the economic problems that Egypt have, which are fairly dire, given that the Saudis and the Gulf are pouring this money in, it doesn't seem like there's much of a role for the United States. Has America been marginalized by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf in terms of its influence?
I don't think so. America has always had influence everywhere, but the leadership today is not to America. The leadership belongs to the Egyptian people. It's neither America nor Saudi Arabia nor the United Arab Emirates nor anybody who can dictate to Egypt what to do. But Egypt today appreciates certain gestures that are done when it is in full crisis. That is exactly the attitude. There is no preference.
Well, of course, Egypt faces an enormous challenge in terms of what they call the youth bulge. My understanding is that every 10 months, a million new people are added to Egypt's population. Is that true?
It is true, but I don't know why you make it such a big problem. One should capitalize on that. On the contrary, these are youthful hands who will help to build the country. This is not a gerontocracy that you can see in Europe, for instance. So this is a youthful population, and when any wise government should capitalize on it and get the most out of it. We have a new generation who is fully on the same level as their international counterparts in the technology revolution and in many aspects of learning. What they need is more training, more experience, and more opportunity, which they never had. Nobody ever paid attention to the youth. Today, it's their day, and in a few years, you will see that they will be in the front line of the leadership.
So just in closing, Dr. Mona Makram, I mean, you clearly are very optimistic about this political change, even though one is always queasy, if you will, about the idea of a military coup or a military takeover. It's not normally...
Because I don't see it as such in the transitional sense of a coup. I see it more like a popular impeachment. I think it is unique in history, in human history, that you have an outpour of anger and of rage of 30 million people taking to the streets. So there must have been something quite wrong. And if it had gone on, inaction would have been much more criminal than intervention, because we were really on the borderline of a civil war and of bloodshed.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Mona Makram Abid.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I was speaking then with Dr. Mona Makram Abid, who recently resigned from Egypt's Shura Council in support of the Tamarod, that's rebellion movement. She is the head of the Committee on Social Rights at the National Council on Human Rights and is a distinguished lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the American University in Cairo, where she's been teaching for the past 17 years. Dr. Makram Abid was a member of parliament in Egypt from 1990 to 1995, and prior to that, she was appointed as an expert to the UN Committee for Policy Development and founded the Association for the Advancement of Education and is a founding member of the Arab Organization for Human Rights. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back further examining the role of Saudi Arabia in the recent coup in Egypt. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I don't know whether you caught much of Dr. Mona Makram Abid, who's recently resigned from Egypt's Shura Council in support of the Tamarod movement that brought down the Morsi government. But, of course, the main question I had for her was that have Tamarod and, again, the secular liberal forces, have they been used by the military in the sense that they brought about the second revolution as they did the first, but the military appear to have grabbed power, and that Saudi Arabia had played a role behind the scenes. She was quite skeptical of both of those charges, even though there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Saudi Arabia has played a fairly important, if not pivotal, role in both undermining the Morsi government and rewarding the new government.
Well, I think on the one hand, of course, the Saudis were opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood and were opposed to Morsi. And so I think that his fall, the seizure of power by the military, certainly serves Saudi interests. I don't know that we can necessarily trace backwards direct Saudi influence. We like to overstate the power and the ability of larger players, both in the region and outside, most importantly the United States, having the ability to dictate events. And I think it's hard to conclusively determine that that's in fact the case here, that the Saudis have been pivotal. Shortly after the military's coup, of course, they promised $5 billion in aid, and they would like to capitalize on transformations that are now taking place. But to say that the Saudis somehow had a role in 30 million people taking to the streets is overstating by a long shot their ability to shape events in the region.
Well, but the question is, did the 30 million in the streets, just as 2 years ago, many of those same people took to the streets, are they really in control of Egypt's destiny, or are the military and the old guard? Because another coincidence, if you will, is that all of the shortages that plagued the Morsi government now appear to be over. And more importantly, the police, who were absent from the streets, suddenly are back on the streets.
Right. Well, we have the New York Times report that the gas lines, or that the gas was sort of mysteriously returned in suitable quantities, that the electricity is back on, which suggests some sort of collusion prior to June 30th between the military, the police, and the protest movement. That very well may be the case, that there has been some backdoor operation and maneuvering going on. But still, I think it's attributing to things more power than they actually have. Look, the reality is we're in the middle of something. I don't see this as a second revolution. I mean, I'm part of the editorial collective at Middle East Report, which had an editorial out just a few days ago that said this distinction between coup and revolution is the wrong question to ask. We're in the middle of a world historical event. What happened this over the last 2 weeks is connected to what happened in 2011. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. It's easy to focus on the moment and to try to guess and ask questions about what role the military is going to play. We don't know. But what we do know is that 30 million people turned out expressing democratic aspiration. That they've done it for the second time in 2 years is really quite remarkable. And I was talking to a colleague of mine a couple of days ago, and it's remarkable. If we want to compare this historically to other revolutions, the French didn't storm Bastille twice. Egyptians have revolted and mobilized popularly twice. For whatever reason, they believe that they hold a considerable amount of power. We know that there's now an outline or a roadmap for a new constitution, new elections in Egypt over the next 6 months. I think we need to see what happens and determine whether or not Egyptians are satisfied with that before we know what the political landscape is going to look like.
And, of course, that was an appropriate allusion, Toby Jones. But today being 14 juillet, the 14th of July, the storming of the anniversary, if you will, of the storming of the Bastille. And, of course, the American Revolution started in 1776 and wasn't really over till 1789. So clearly you don't have overnight governments in any historical context. That's not to say, though, that there's not a rivalry, shall we say, between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Recently, when they were meeting in Doha over the future of the Syrian rebels, the Free Syrian Army versus the Saudi surrogates, which appear to be more of the al-Nusra types, Qatar, of course, supports the Muslim Brotherhood, as does the government in Turkey, which is a Muslim Brotherhood government. So you have throughout the region, you have people that are for the Muslim Brotherhood, like Turkey, like Qatar, and of course the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood that's just fallen. And then you have people like King Hussein, who has problems with his own opposition in terms of a Muslim Brotherhood movement, which he of course opposes. And then you have the Saudis, who let's get to that basic question. Does this monarchy fear an alternative Islamic rule of a more Islamic democracy than the autocratic system that they have in Saudi Arabia that uses the Wahhabis as their kind of pious front, if you will?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that the Saudis fear the power of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they are working at cross purposes against Qatar, against Turkey, against Hamas, and certainly against the Brotherhood in Egypt. The Saudis would like nothing more than to see good old-fashioned military-dominated autocracies across the region. They have no investment. We need to keep this very simple point in mind when thinking about the Saudis and their geopolitical interests. They are pragmatic. They have a clear sense of what serves their interests. And the best thing is for there not to be a vibrant ideological landscape across the region. The Saudis want autocrats and tyrants to be in power in order to stabilize the region. Now, the reasons that they aspire to this, I think, are twofold. And one is a kind of general, perhaps abstract sensibility that they're anxious about what democratic politics might mean, no matter what shape it takes, whether it's Islamists or whether it's something else. They would hate for there to be a further demonstration effect. But there's something else at play here that's specific to the ideology and the historic role of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that is to say that the Saudis from the late 70s into the 1980s faced their own domestic political opposition movement that was rooted in the regional Muslim Brotherhood. And the Saudis, I think, are not only operating out of a sense of regional anxiety, but are attuned to their own domestic history and the power and the potential power of the Muslim Brotherhood to challenge them at home. So I think it's for these two reasons. One is anxiety is generally about the possibility of democracy, as well as their specific discomfort with the Muslim Brotherhood historically in the region.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Jones, who's professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. So, if this is a if there's a surrogate struggle going on, and we know in the broader sense in the Middle East there's a surrogate war going on or a power struggle, however you want to characterize it, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and Syria, of course, is often referred to as a proxy war. But within that proxy war, there are also another proxy war, and that seems to be between Qatar's support for the Free Syrian Army and by extension the Muslim Brotherhood, and Saudi Arabia's support apparently for the more radical forces of al-Nusra and these others. Now, you've already had evidence that within the Syrian civil war, there's a war that could possibly break out between the rebels factions, with three Syrian army commander recently being shot by an al-Nusra front rebel. And I think the al-Nusra people captured a couple of Free Syrian Army people and beheaded them. So do you think that, first of all, do you accept the premise that there are proxy wars within proxy wars?
I absolutely do. I do think that you've got the Saudis and the Qataris and others, you know, working for, you know, their own interests and own advantage. And the Syrians pay the heaviest price for all of this. But I absolutely agree that that the battlefield in Syria is muddled. Who counts as the opposition? Who counts as pro-regime? It really obscures the terrible ways that there are cleavages, particularly on the opposition side of things, that could potentially become combustible. And they're certainly long-term toxic. If we've not learned anything from Afghanistan, it's that while these forces are unleashed in a particular battlefield, they seem to serve the interests of their patrons. But once the fighting in Syria is over, I think you'll see the potential for spillover and for this to have a life of its own. And the Saudis are driving the hardest in making things both as less clear as possible, but also as difficult to manage as possible.
And Toby Jones, fairly recently I spoke with a member of the Saudi opposition, Dr. Ali Al-Yami. And he was saying that Saudi Arabia is repeating what happened during the Afghan war against the Soviet Union, in the sense that they're emptying their jails and the judges are giving young Saudi dissidents a choice. Either you go to jail or you go off to fight, in this case, not in Afghanistan, but in Syria. Is that going on, to your understanding?
I think that's one very powerful interpretation of things. I mean, I don't have any material evidence to suggest that it's true, but I think that it's right, and I do think that Syria now is more like Afghanistan in the 80s than, say, the Iraq Jihad during the period of the American occupation. I think in that case, the Saudis were nervous about providing direct political cover for the jihadis, although Saudis were making their way to Iraq. Here, the Saudis are much more directly involved in providing weapons and materiel for their favored actors in Syria, and it does look an awful lot like Afghanistan.
So on the other side, on the Qatari side, who support the Muslim Brotherhood, and they, after all, Qatar has lent Egypt more than $7 billion during Morsi's year in power, so they're putting their money where their mouth is. What is the reasons behind this Gulf monarchy, which is not unlike the Saudi ruling family? Why do they support this broader democratic experiment that the Muslim Brotherhood represent, as opposed to it's a monarchy. Maybe it has a more friendly face than the Al Saud monarchy, but the Al Thanis are still absolute rulers, aren't they?
Well, they are. I think that we have to be careful. There is a Qatari, and there is also a Saudi version of Kremlinology that's certainly possible here. It's difficult to crawl inside the heads of the key actors, particularly in what is a relatively short period after a transfer of power in Qatar, to know exactly what's going on. I think the Qataris are less committed to anything in particular than they are in embellishing and strengthening their own profile. I mean, over the past decade or so, they've played an outsized role in the region, certainly outsized geographically, but also their historic role has never been particularly pronounced. And I think that in the last 2 years, the Qataris have latched on to the Muslim Brotherhood, particularly in Egypt, but also in Syria, building alliances with Turkey as a way to establish themselves. They thought that they picked winners. I don't know that there's an ideological angle here, or at least not one that was there 3 or 4 years ago. It may have become the case more recently. But I simply think that the Qataris thought that they had, that they had picked the winning team and that they were going to roll with that, and found themselves, unfortunately for them, on the wrong side.
But in the broader sense, though, doesn't in many ways the shadow of Algeria hang over this whole issue that's happening in Egypt, which is the idea that a lot of Western analysts, particularly on the neoconservative side, see Islamic democracy as one man, one vote, one time. And that was the fear that happened in Algeria some years back, where the Islamic Salvation Front, the FIS, looked like they were about to win the elections, and the military stepped in and annulled the elections. And what ensued was a very, very bloody civil war in which at least 200,000 people were slaughtered. So surely if this is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, if you treat the Muslim Brotherhood as though they are like the FIS, that you can't trust them, that you give them democracy and then they turn it into theocracy, the former member of Egypt's Shura Council, Dr. Mona Makrim Abid, was saying earlier was that she feels and is very insistent that they're going to bring the Muslim Brotherhood back into the political process. So what's your sense on how you do that? Because I would think if I were a member of the Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, I'd be beginning to think maybe that they don't believe that we are capable of participating in the democratic process. It's like in a marriage accusing your spouse of having an affair when they didn't really have an affair. You see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, I think there's a couple of things to tease out here. On the one hand, you know, the Tamarud movement, I mean, I think expressed a similar set of anxieties and frustrations with the political and economic system in Egypt that ousted Mubarak. And that is to say that Mubarakism lived on under the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi was more interested in consolidating the power of the Brotherhood at the expense of real democratic politics. So we shouldn't get too caught up in calling the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist Democrats. They largely have themselves to blame for the anger that ousted them from power in June 30th, as well as obviously the collusion of the military with the protest movement. But I also think that the Muslim Brotherhood actually operates better. It's a more effective and kind of has a greater degree of coherence when it is an opposition movement and is outside of power. And for that reason, I think it does need to be included in the political system. One would hope that they'll participate if given the advantage. But I can also, you know, it's easy to anticipate that they'd elect to opt out precisely as you suggested, because they won't trust it. They won't trust that it will provide the kinds of protections that are necessary for them to be active and to participate. And here again, I think we have to wait and see exactly what's going to happen. If the military continues to slaughter people and to behave as it did in the middle of 2011, then Egypt has long-term problems. And it'll be up to the military to yield that kind of political power. I don't think the military wants de jure political authority, but are they willing to allow democracy to sort of flourish, one that includes the Brotherhood, a system that includes, I simply, at this point, nobody knows.
Well, just in closing then, Toby Jones, let's assume that they're able to, this transitional government is able to shift from military rule to civilian rule, and that they lay the groundwork, as Dr. Mona Makram Abid was suggesting, for a real parliament, a real lower house, and that they have free and fair and open elections and that everybody participates. If that were the case, and that's certainly a pretty big wish list there, how do you think the Muslim Brotherhood would fare in a free and fair elections after what's happened?
Well, at this point, given the turnout on June 30th, I don't think they'd fare particularly well, at least not as well as they did in 2012. I do think the political polling, opinion polling, and others demonstrated and showed quite conclusively that the Brotherhood had lost a great deal of support from the elections up to the point of June 30th. They were not the most popular political network in the country, as they had been previously. I mean, this is what happens to electorates, right? They're educated, they learn, there's something pedagogical about elections and about the democratic experiment and process. That is, that people can evaluate in a transparent process how those that they put in positions of authority behave. The Muslim Brotherhood didn't behave democratically, so it's no wonder that millions of people who believed that they had created the conditions for something new, something non-autocratic, were ready to throw the Brotherhood out of power.
Well, Toby Jones, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst on the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the verdict in the Trayvon Martin case.
Families and the students all confused and awed, weeping through each other's arms. It's murder. New absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. Shell, shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Nunn.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And there are a number of questions about the competence and effectiveness of the prosecution in the Trayvon Martin case, given that Zimmerman, George Zimmerman, was acquitted on all charges. So it was a rout for the prosecution. Let's go through some of the apparent failures and try and figure out how and why they happened. These are the ones that I've listed, and you may have more. One, not having an African-American on the jury. Two, not allowing the issue of race to enter the trial. And three, inadequate jury instructions explaining all of the statutes in the Stand Your Ground law, particularly one that prohibits an armed citizen from being the aggressor. So let's begin with the first, if you will. Why not an African-American on the jury?
Well, he's being charged with second-degree murder and with manslaughter, which both are charges that are based on the quality of the defendant's behavior. That is it reckless or some form of extreme recklessness or negligent? And also, the defense he was raising was self-defense, which raises the question of whether or not it's reasonable or not. And both of those issues, that is, whether a person's unintentional conduct, that's what we call recklessness and negligence in criminal parlance, and the decision as to whether or not self-defense should be used, basically are cultural questions. Those are questions that are based on your worldview. Those are really, you know, questions of reasonableness, and reasonableness is always a
subjective
determination masquerading as an objective one. So because of that, who you have on the jury is really critical.
So why, I mean, in terms of jury selection, was it possible for the prosecution to insist on an African-American juror since they were all women and they were all white, weren't they?
No, it's not possible for them to insist upon one. But what it is possible to do is to manage your jury selection in a way. so that you're paying attention to the ultimate outcome. And to do everything in your power, as I'm sure George Zimmerman's attorneys did everything in their power to make sure that there were not African Americans on those juries. Now, there's a case called Batson, and then all the cases that come after it that have argued that you can't explicitly use race as a reason to exclude someone from a jury, and that applies to white jurors as well as African American and other minority jurors. But even so, you know, there are techniques that lawyers learn as they go through the process, and they can figure out how to kind of raise arguments and how to shape their questions in a way so that they can be attentive to that. So that's one of the concerns that I was concerned at the outset when it turned out in a area that has as many African Americans as they do in Sanford that there were none on this jury.
And Kenneth Nunn, again, professor of law at the University of Florida and associate director of the Center for Children and Families in Gainesville, Florida. Let's turn to the second issue. Why did the judge not allow the issue of race to enter the trial? Surely the prosecution should have challenged that.
Well, they surely should have challenged that. I mean, I think that the judge's perspective and certainly the defense's perspective is that that would be inflammatory and it would direct the jury away from considering the evidence in the case. And that certainly is one way to look at race. That is, race is, or to talk about racial divisions and racial issues and racial perspectives is always something that's essentially emotional and is not practical, doesn't focus on facts. And that's one view of it, and I'd have to say it's probably the dominant political view today. But if you were to look at the literature of people who actually study race, whether we're talking about sociologists or, you know, law professors such as myself, there's another view of race which talks about the degree that it permeates the culture in which we live, and it's a part of our environment and our reality, and you can't get away from it so easily by simply ignoring it. And so discussion of that character of race, talk about unconscious racism or implicit racism, and whether or not this was a case where a black man was being profiled because he fit some sort of stereotype, I think was a legitimate issue for the jury to be aware of and to be talking about when they were evaluating the reasonableness of George Zimmerman's behavior.
Well, it's hard for me not to see race as being absolutely inherent in this whole situation. Not to suggest that Zimmerman was a racist, but he seemed to think that there were these people, outsiders, whatever you want to call them, that were affecting the security of this community. I mean, he had literally volunteered to go out there and be a kind of vigilante, looking for crime where it didn't necessarily exist and looking for people that he considered to be perpetrators of crime. So were they able to establish his worldview, Zimmerman's worldview, that who was responsible for crime? And There he was, you know, a self-appointed crime fighter.
Well, a lot of people think that in order to be a racist or that, you know, in order to do something that has racist connotations, you have to be kind of an old-fashioned Southern sheriff or Klansman or something of that nature. And I think that's the wrong perspective to have. And from that perspective, people get offended when you bring race into the discussion to talk about why people are performing the way that they're performing. Well, why do you have to play the race card is the retort that you hear a lot. But it isn't necessarily true that every time you are talking about the impact of race that you're saying that someone has a, you know, malicious intent of some sort. It may simply be something that's unconscious, that they're not aware of, that they were, as we were discussing, raised in a particular cultural environment. And so to them, they don't even see the racist content of what their behavior is. Now, it's also true that we know from studies of jurors and when, you know, how they vote on cases, that it's quite helpful in circumstances where there is a racial dimension to the facts to have a person of color on the jury to help interpret that possibility for the other jurors who don't even think about those things. It's
not racist,
they just don't think about them.
Well, but surely, Kenneth Nunn, that would have been helpful to have an African-American on the jury to explain the key witness who most analysts and, frankly, most of what you saw on television, you couldn't avoid this trial. I mean, it was absolutely ubiquitous everywhere on television. The takeaway was that Janelle was a terrible witness, etc. But, you know, surely she needed explaining, didn't she?
You're talking about Rachel Gentile. She did, because there probably weren't many people from the suburban middle-class background that my guess is most of these jurors come from. Who have run into young girls or boys like Rachel Gentile, who understand the language, who understand the use of slang, who understand the way that they would want to, not be in the public limelight, and all of that. I mean, she, I've worked in and lived in inner city communities all my life. And I can certainly tell you that she was not unique. She was not some sort of strange, person who just, dropped down from the sky. But she, she was sort of a regular, ordinary, salt-of-the-earth young lady from that community whose sincerity could really be established if you were familiar with her background and what she was talking about. So I think that either having a person on the jury, certainly who was familiar with that, either through their background experience or from their upbringing, would have been helpful.
And let's go then to the third point, and that is the inadequate jury instructions explaining all of the statutes in the Stand Your Ground law, particularly one that prohibits an armed citizen from being the aggressor. So explain that part of the statute, and for the life of me, I don't understand why that was not included in the jury instructions.
Right. Well, let's walk that through. We were talking earlier about how homicide has these different grades. And for each of them, you have to decide what was the character of the person's behavior, because you always have what was their mental state. Basically, you always have the fact that there is a person who's been killed, and so that's constant with all homicide. But the reason why they were killed makes a difference in how we grade it. And then after that, you will always see routinely see self-defense offered as a defense in the case. And in order to claim self-defense, you have to show that it was reasonable for you to use deadly force on that occasion against that person. So so in that regard, Florida law is pretty standard. But there's another principle, and that is, if you have the opportunity to leave a violent conflict without getting hurt yourself, and the only other way you could end the conflict was to kill somebody, should you be required to leave the conflict and not result in action that will result in somebody's death? And so what that rule is called the retreat rule. It's like you should retreat before you kill somebody. And ordinarily, the majority of American states say, yes, you have to retreat before you use deadly force. Florida and sort of a minority of states say, no, you don't, that you can stand your ground, and even if it was perfectly safe for you to leave, to go back in your car or back in your house, you don't have to. And so they were instructed on the stand your ground aspect, that is, you have a right to use deadly force and not retreat first. But there are facts in this case that would say that that rule would not apply, because that rule only applies when the defendant was not the person who precipitated the conflict in the first place. So I thought that the prosecution should have insisted on that part of the instructions being read to the jury, and they weren't.
So, Kenneth Nunn, professor of law at the University of Florida and associate director of the Center for Children and Families, do you have children?
I do.
I'm thinking of what the president said at the beginning of this Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman incident some time back when it happened, that Trayvon Martin could have been his son. I'm paraphrasing what the president said.
Right.
That still hangs over us, doesn't it? I mean, and hangs over you as an African-American parent.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, I think the problem with the verdict in this case is it seems to suggest that young African-American males have to have a heightened sensitivity to the way that they impact other people, whether it is their fault or not, and that whenever anyone may be frightened by them or unduly suspicious of them, that their lives are at risk. And, you know, as an African-American parent, I don't have any sons, but I do have daughters. But I do know that's something that African-American parents tell their children anyway. But one certainly would hope that you didn't have to live in a country or in a world where that was the nature of reality that you faced.
And also, I thought that adding insult to injury was all that speculation that African-American communities would explode in rage. So that was some kind of a reflex.
Well, you know, it's when you start talking about the way that race played in the case, the first issue is, well, blacks are dangerous, they're violent. You know, they're wearing hoodies, they're walking through our neighborhood, they must be about to commit a crime. And what else do we know about blacks? We know, you know, another motif I hear a lot in connection with this case is how emotional blacks are. Well, that was an emotional outburst from Rachel John Teal, or the people who were protesting were working on emotion. So there's all this issue about emotion and violence and all of that. So one would expect, if you believe that, that you would think, oh, the black community is going to blow up because of the verdict in the case. That didn't happen.
Well, Kenneth Nunn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Ian. Best wishes.
Same to you. Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center for Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in America.